a rise of a confessional Christian Inquisition is not an answer to a Pythocracy.
Welcome back to Mind Matters, everyone. I'm Harrison Cayley with Elon Martin. Joined for the, I don't know, is this your fifth appearance, Arthur? It's getting up there, but but another appearance with Dr. Arthur Versluis, author of most recently, American Gnosis, Political Religion and Transcendence. So we talked about this last, we talked a little bit about this book last time. We've now finished the book, so we're going to continue and maybe even conclude our discussion of it. With that said, welcome back, Arthur. Looking forward to this talk.
I'm looking forward to it too. It's always good to be with you and talk about these different things and explore subjects. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. To give viewers who might have missed that one, I'll just give a very brief summary of some of what this book discusses. I'll start with the conclusion, because it kind of wraps everything up. You cover a lot of ground in this book, from literature to psychedelics to strange esoteric traditions and philosophies, some idiosyncratic and enigmatic, and some with more of a traditional or long heritage. We get into figures like, well, everyone from Philip K. Dick and David Icke to some Buddhist or para-perennial Buddhists, all in the American tradition. So there's spanning the gamut from what you call neo-Gnosticism to Gnosticism, and you delineate some subcategories of Gnosticism, going from the cosmological, that's kind of like the worldly based, dualistic in nature. So it might go from very, very material and dualist to maybe a higher form of matter or some kind of a higher dimensions, but still that separateness, to the Gnostic traditions, or the tradition going in the direction of Gnosis, which you define more as as transcendence, or an experience of transcending that dual notion. So in the end of the book, after looking at this entire history and trajectory of American neo-Gnosticism, which we can trace back, you know, you do it back to at the very least the 1800s and some of the great American authors and writers and thinkers of the 1800s to the present through film and academia, in the sense of different studies of different things like psychedelics and to the alternative voices. And but you make the point that there seems to, in this whole trend of neo-Gnosticism, you seem to have a majority of what you'd call neo-Gnosticism without Gnosis, and then you've got Gnosis without neo-Gnosticism. Did I get that right? And could you maybe just go into that a bit and let us know your take on that kind of broad look at the whole subject of neo-Gnosticism?
Yeah, sure. Because what you point to is right at the heart of the book. It is really divided across that kind of almost barrier, you would say. There are one or two authors that go beyond it, I think. But largely what you have is these neo-Gnostic themes, which would include the sense that we're living in a hostile society, hostile to spiritual progress, that there are people or beings that are hostile to spiritual progress, that there's an artificial creator called a demiurge that could be construed, and it often is in films, as an AI system or some kind of virtual or false reality that gets created. In that sense, and in a lot of senses, neo-Gnosticism provides it's like it was designed for our time as a way of understanding things in society in a different way. And it's very present in literature, as you say, going back to Melville. It's absolutely clear, and I showed 20 years ago that Melville had definite familiarity with Gnosticism in antiquity, and Gnosticism as we would think about it in terms of neo-Gnosticism, actually. And all the way from Melville in the 1800s up to the present, you have these themes in literature and film. But when you look at literature and film, and what I show in the book is there's almost no Gnosis in there, right? The only Gnosis you can see in Melville, for example, as far as I can tell, is that you can define it potentially as insight into the hostile nature of the cosmos in which we find ourselves, right? That nature is somehow hostile to us. And you see that in Cormac McCarthy too, and in many other great authors. You know, Cormac McCarthy is fantastic. He's amazing as a novelist. But there's no Gnosis in there in the way it's defined in the book, which is defined as transcendence of self and other. It's transcendence of subject and object. And that's also the way it's defined in Buddhism. So that's what I call cosmological gnosis, is it's gnosis as insight into, or socio-political gnosis, using neo-Gnostic metaphors to understand the hostile nature of the society we inhabit, which can be understood as pathocracy, run by pathocrats. There are a variety of different ways of saying that, and understanding that can be seen as a kind of gnosis, but it's not classical gnosis in the way it's defined in Buddhist translations. In Buddhist translations of Tibetan words, of Tibetan concepts or ways of understanding, gnosis means the transcendence of subject and object, or transcendence of self and other. And that's pretty widely used at this point. You don't find that in film. Maybe here and there you kind of get a hint that possibly if you like really bent far enough and you kind of twist it around sideways, you could kind of almost touch it. But really, no, I don't think so. And when you shift to some of the later people that I discuss in the book, for example, Joel Morwood. Joel Morwood lives out in Oregon. He's a Vietnam War veteran. He was at one time a true believer in communism, and even went to communist China, and you know, was given a grand tour by, you know, the people that just murdered, you know, who knows how many, you know, millions. And he realized it was all fake, the tour, right? That the things they were telling him were lies. And he came back to America and he was kind of lost. And then he had this spiritual awakening experience, which changed his entire life. And he wrote about it in a book in Gnostic terms. But in that book, there's explicitly it's Gnostic, but without any neo-Gnostic themes to speak of. He doesn't talk about a demiurge or hostile beings like archons or, you know, anything like that. What he talks about is this experience of joyous transcendence. That's gnosis, much more in the classical way of understanding it, which you see carried to the Christian tradition in a kind of almost subterranean way, in a kind of it's like packed in the bags of the caravan, but very few people get to it. And it's there. I discuss it in a book at length called Platonic Mysticism. And what Morwood is doing is a lot. It's very much attuned with Platonic mysticism in the tradition of Ralph Waldo Emerson, transcendentalism, the idea that as a non-aligned spiritual practitioner, you can have spiritual insight. And that is a very deep American tradition. And that tradition is, you can call it perennial. That's a term that I've used in a book called Perennial Philosophy, which discusses perennial philosophy in a way that is fundamentally different than the way a lot of people do, because it is about non-aligned spirituality, but it is not necessarily saying that all religions go to the same place, which is what people usually say perennial philosophy is. That's not really what it is in the tradition. With Morewood, it kind of is. He's basically drawing on all the different religious traditions in order to create a kind of American synthesis. He's not alone in this. His mentor was Franklin Merrill Wolfe, who also did that. And these are really remarkable people. I mean, Franklin Merrill Wolfe, he's an extraordinary figure and quite charming, actually, in a lot of ways. Also brilliant. And again, an unaligned spiritual tradition, but very deeply indebted to Buddhism. When you look at Morewood's book, and I say this in American Gnosis, his most recent book has a bunch of spiritual practices. And where do those come from? Almost completely, they come from Tibetan Buddhism. They're like, you know, the dream yoga, everything. It's where do you find that? I mean, you only find that in Tibetan Buddhism. So even though there's this kind of gesture toward all religions lead to the same place, well, I don't think so. But it if the same place is Buddhism, yeah, then they all lead to the same place. Then I agree. Then that's right. Based on what he's saying, right? This is kind of the sub message of the book. And that leads to a whole set of questions, right? So Gnosis is fundamentally different than neo-Gnosticism. And the book has that set of themes, dividing it, characterized as neo-Gnosticism without Gnosis and Gnosis without neo-Gnosticism. And it took me a while to come to that formulation, actually. It didn't come first. It came after, right?
Yeah. Yeah. After kind of looking at it all. Yeah. I can see how that would happen. That leads me to a question, because while you wrote that. And so as I was reading about that, there are a couple points around that time where you say, oh, well, you know, a couple of these figures kind of seem to straddle, you know, both sides of the equation at times, like, I think like, how do you pronounce his name? I forget. Charles de Musset's.
Muses.
Yep. And even maybe like Stephen Huller.
Yep.
There are hints of it. And that made me wonder, because we've talked about, and I've read a bunch of your other books on like Christian theosophy. So going back to, you know, Jacob Boehme, and I'm wondering if there's a way, like, how would you characterize that theosophical movement? Could you make an argument that there are neo-Gnostic elements in Boehme about like the world of wrath and the kind of these wrathful beings and things like that? But at the same time, you've got this kind of non-dual, via negativa practice and philosophy going on. So how would you characterize that? Or would you see them as kind of straddling both of those worlds?
Yeah. Yeah. That's really insightful. You're absolutely right on that. It's not in that division that we started with is not inherent. There's no inherent, like, locked in quality where you got to have one or not the other. There's no intrinsic reason that there, it's more like a spectrum, right? And it's possible to bridge the gap, as it were. And Huller does it. Stephen Huller, he includes all of the classical elements we would associate with neo-Gnosticism. the archons, the demiurge, and so on. At the same time, he also includes transcendence. And he, not incidentally, as it turns out, was a refugee from communism. He had seen it in action, like this Zhivan fleet. He saw it. She in China grew up in the Cultural Revolution. I know someone who grew up in the Cultural Revolution and experienced it firsthand. So you can see how that shaped that kind of experience behind the Iron Curtain. In the case of Huller, produced his emphasis on freedom. His work on Alchemy of Freedom that's an important book, actually. And so he's someone who really does bridge, to some extent, you know, the gap. That's why I said it's not absolute. And there's no intrinsic reason that you have to have it that way. It's just that we live in a secular society, and a lot of people who are doing films or writing, you know, fiction are not necessarily, they're drawing on these strands that pre-exist them, that are there, but they're not necessarily even aware, really, of, why would they be aware of Dionysus the Areopagite, for example? You got to hunt, you know, you got to be, really, even if you're Christian, even if you're like deeply Christian, you may never have heard of the most important mystical figure in your entire tradition, right? For Western Christianity. Well, then that leads to the question, why is that, right? You do, though, have these extraordinary figures, and you know, Huller is certainly one. Musis is another. He's pretty cosmological. I mean, he was totally into, like, theories of physics and vibrational harmonics and all sorts of exotic things. But there's at least hints of transcendence in there. But he's not like Huller, who really developed, you know, a whole contemporary Gnostic kind of complete worldview, right?
But in your book, that one of the points that seems to be apparent is that precisely what makes Gnosticism so valid a experience or an idea is that you have people who have no knowledge of history, these figures who've discussed Gnosticism in various ways, or access to any of the research, and yet people seem to be embodying or communicating Gnostic ideas out of instinct, out of a connection to some archetypal form or idea or insight that just is something that they naturally gravitate towards. And so it becomes the material of novels and movies and dissidents on the right and all sorts of people who have something to say about something. It comes up. It's like part of a wellspring in response to what people are seeing in the world, or not in reaction to what they're seeing, but just a natural expression of what they're aligned with without even, like you say, being conscious of it. That's what's so fascinating to me about it. It's like, you know, on a different topic, it's like watching Vertigo by Alfred Hitchcock and seeing the Orphic myth be revitalized or re-expressed in some way. And, you know, it's just there. It's just something to be connected to in the ether. And that's what validates it even more, in my opinion.
Well, that's right. And it points to something that is there in my book called Perennial Philosophy. It's that, you know, some things are just true. And if they're true, then people are going to find them. And that's a different way of saying some, at least some of this. I realize, and I've, being in academia, you hear all the time, oh, you have your own truth and so on. But that is an assertion. It's what I call a preemptive assertion. It's presumptive. It's a presumptive assertion preempting dissent from it. In other words, you just assert, well, we all have our own truth. There's just random truths floating around and so on. But what if that's not the case, right? What if that's not the case? What if there are characteristics of truth that are just, they're true, and that's just actually how it is? That's a different way of seeing things, which is, in our contemporary society, actually very radical, right? It's radical in the sense, not of political radicalism, but of getting to the root of things, getting to that heart of things. That's what the word radical really refers to. So that's an interesting observation, I think, for thinking about dissidents within our society, actually, especially in the contemporary moment.
Well, I want to come back to something that you said, Ilan, about the response. When I was reading through the last chapters, of course, you bring in Lobachevsky's work in relation to Josh Neal, is that his name?
Yes.
And because Neal uses Lobachevsky's work, and so one of the points that you've made right, in this discussion so far today as well, is that it seems that neo-Gnosticism is a good description, a good framework for understanding pathocracy. And so I had a couple ideas on that. One is that it's almost like neo-Gnostic ideas, not necessarily even in the precise language of the Gnostic texts that, with words like Archon and the Demiurge, but the scenario of living under a pathocracy, it seems like developing some kind of neo-Gnostic understanding of the world is almost a natural response to a pathocratic environment. Because like you said, it's true on some level, and we can go through the levels. Like it's at the very least metaphorically true when you're living under a pathocracy. You do have archons who are working against your best interests, that are manipulating reality and for their own gains. Like that's just what happens. That's what happened in communism. It's what happens arguably all over the place at various different times and in numerous different ways, with numerous different ideological cloaks. And so, but that raises another question for me, is that, okay, so we have this natural kind of response to a kind of political, socio-political subjugation of a sort and a weird sort of, anti-social structure. But why do people come to the images they do? Why is it supernatural beings? Like why archons? Why not just, corrupt politicians? Why does it have to be like demons, that kind of thing? And that ties in to what you were just saying. Well, why is it that humans go to these things? Is it just like some, if we just use the materialist framework, do we just try to explain it away in terms of, oh, well, that's just the types of language that people use because they're superstitious or whatever. Is there an insight into something deeper that's going on? Because there, if you look at the traditions on, demons or whatever, there are numerous different names for some kind of supernatural being that influences and controls, or attempts to control humans. And we see that in numerous religious traditions. We just mentioned like Jakob Boehme and like these wrathful beings, and you've got the paintings of, I can't remember the saint, but there's a famous saint, and all of the paintings of him, he's like, he might be floating through the air or something, and he's just got like all these little demonic imps like latched onto him. And it seems to be that the imagery of beings of this sort is you know, it seems to be part of that natural response. So the question to me is, okay, if people are gaining an insight into the nature of sociopolitical reality, that might be like this first level of gnosis is coming to see and know the truth about, or coming to see and know more of the truth about the nature of the world that we're in. Maybe these are like these progressive insights into the nature of reality. And maybe there's a hint that, okay, well, maybe there's more to reality than we in our kind of secular materialist worldview accept. Maybe that's approaching something, some other reality that actually is impinging on ours in some way. And just one last kind of thought on this weird chain of associations, but you mentioned Platonic mysticism. And in Plato's cave, this is a point that Diana Pazulka brings up, is that in Plato's cave, most philosophers and academics kind of, they don't spend very much time focusing on one of the figures in the cave. And that is the people who are projecting the shadows. And she made the point, she brought this up with like numerous philosophers of Plato, like her colleagues. And they said, well, what about these guys? You know, Plato seems to be saying something about these guys are actively like launching, like they're putting on a show, a disinformation campaign. What about these guys? And they're like, oh, well, that's just a metaphor or something. And, you know, finally she found a couple of guys who were like, yeah, no, I totally agree. That's very interesting. So with that kind of just, with that kind of like rambling introduction, just, I want to hear your thoughts on that. Yeah. So yeah, what are your thoughts on all that?
Well, I'm actually working. Well, I have been until, and I will be again. I had to pause for a little bit, but I'm working on a book on materialism, and we live in a society here, really, I would say much more, certainly globally, as well as specifically in the United States or in North America, society in general inculcates materialism in ways, a materialistic paradigm, in ways that we don't necessarily even pick up on. It's so deeply embedded. It is in everything. It's all around us all the time. And we're not really even aware of it, because it's like air or water or something. It's just omnipresent. And I think that is very much tied to what you're talking about, because it's very challenging to that paradigm to start thinking about questions like, okay, so in Plato's allegory of the cave, who's projecting? Like, is anybody really responsible for this? And if somebody's actually responsible for the shadows on the wall and kind of the setup, what is that really saying? And that's why Platonism and Gnosticism and Hermetism in antiquity are actually, they're not, you know, yeah, there's different words, right? But when you go back and you look at scholarship, and a lot of scholars of that period will say, it's really hard to pull them apart, because, and you look at the Nag Hammadi library, it includes Gnostic and Platonic texts. It's not just Gnostic, it's Hermetic and Platonic texts, as well as Gnostic. It's all three. And why is that? Well, it could be that these are different insights, different ways of saying something that's actually related about the nature of reality. And I will say, you know, materialism has produced extraordinary results. A materialist paradigm produces the Zoom we're using. It produces, you know, the computers, it produces the airplanes, the technology, the insights from, or lack of insights or whatever, from quantum physics and all sorts of things. So I'm not saying that a materialist paradigm doesn't have utility. It has great utility. But what if it's only one aspect of the reality we inhabit? What if there are actually other aspects? That's just objectively, you have to entertain that possibility. And once you start to entertain that possibility, then all sorts of other things start to occur to you. And so that's why what we're talking about when we talk about what's in American Gnosis is not necessarily only metaphors, right? It's not necessarily only metaphors. It's that's something that Mises talked about and wrote about and was exploring in different ways. And a number of people in there are. So those are a few remarks I would have about that, because I think that perception that the materialism that we take for granted, that is implicit in all these different things that are presented as factual to us, might actually be deceptive. Because if there are other things that are also real, and maybe even more real, then our whole worldview has to change, and in order to incorporate those. And that's the challenge that Gnosticism provides in a very concise way in terms of its different themes and elements. Also, theosophy, by the way. Theosophy does the same thing. Christian theosophy, they do the same thing. Christian theosophy is very Gnostic, exactly as you said. It has many themes that are very close to Gnosticism, put it that way.
Well, the last time you were here, Arthur, we talked a little bit about the term conspirituality, which is the idea that there is a new awareness of the validity of conspiracies, as well as maybe a new outside-the-box sense of spirituality or spiritual growth that kind of goes hand in hand a little bit. And it's odd, but I was reminded of this idea just a few nights ago. I was watching an interview with an actor who was on Sanford and Son. I don't know if you ever watched that show in the 70s with Red Fox. But Damond Wilson, who played opposite Red Fox, is a very funny comedy show, was doing an interview about this very successful show. And as it happens, he turned into a pastor after he was done with Hollywood, became a pastor for 30 years, went on a world tour, and wrote a book about 10 or 15 years ago that had to do with the New World Order and the Illuminati. And at the end of the interview, when the interviewer was asking him, you know, if he had any advice for people, he said, yeah, pray to Jesus Christ with all of your might. We're living in a spiritual battle right now, spiritual warfare. And so, you know, I thought about the themes in your book and the fact that this this kind of, you know, washed up actor who became a pastor who went on to write this material that's neo-Gnostic, effectively, that affirms the reality of archonotic Gnosticism in a way. It's affirming that reality. And so it seems to me that there is, these ideas are sprawling. They're everywhere. And really, it was the very last thing I expected to hear from, I don't even know why I watched this interview. He's not a particularly interesting actor. He was just someone I watched 50 years ago on some comedy that made an impression on me as a kid. And yet, all of these ideas have trickled down. And I have no reason to believe that he wasn't absolutely sincere in suggesting to people that they... to his mind, the best way to protect themselves and engage in a this warfare, not directly, but that there was a warfare and he was affirming it, was to pray. I mean, this was his highest truth. So it was to me just another example of how pervasive all of this is. And you give many examples, many more than I imagined were out there, even though I was aware of some of them. So I don't know that I really had a point in mentioning all that, except to say that, that this, you know, conspirituality, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, seems to be a very big thing, that there is among many people, not just an understanding that there are these demiurges and beings that are seeking to oppress, but that in knowing that, there also needs to be some kind of reaching for an inner light that exists probably both within and without us, and that you can't really have one without the other if you want to be balanced about the whole thing. So maybe you have some comments on that dynamic.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point that you make, because on the one side, focusing on conspirituality or focusing on the dark side, as it were, can be pretty depressing, right? Because you look at, you know, I give a lot of examples in the book, or at least a number of them, of people who have, as it were, gone down the rabbit hole, right? That's the term that folks will use. Well, you go down the rabbit hole, as it were, of conspiracies, and the world looks different, and you do have insight into things that are going on, but there's not anything you can do. And so a lot of people go down the rabbit hole, they get really depressed. And I give some examples of people, you know, who say, you know, they confess, well, you know, I now look at the world and I think, you know, this is hopeless because it's a spiritual battle and the bad guys are winning. And, you know, my eyes are open, but I don't know what to do. And that's where the spectrum is. And I talk about a spectrum where, and I show that on Gab, for example, the social media network, you have some people who are, they've gone, you could say that, you know, if you want to use that term, they've gone down the rabbit hole then, but then they have moved toward affirming a spiritual practice of some kind. Like David Icke does that a lot, actually. And I think we alluded to that before. So that's, you know, I think that's an important dimension of for health, for balance, and for hope, for optimism, is to have that spiritual practice. And that Icke refers to that frequently. Not everybody does. There are people who focus primarily on the conspiracies, and that can get depressing after a while, I think. But then there's something else in response to what you're saying I wanted to mention, and that is in the book, I refer to anti-Gnosticism. I refer to Erik Voegelin and to a kind of anti-Gnostic thinking on the right. And I wanted to talk about that briefly because I wanted to read you something. I got a quotation from Nick Fuentes, who's an online commentator, and he's fairly well known. He does, you know, pretty frequent America First podcast. And he, in December of 2023, in a live stream, this is what he said. He said, this is a direct quotation. "There's an occult element at the highest levels of society, and specifically among the Jews. So many people who are perpetrating lies and destruction on the country, they're evildoers. They're people who worship false gods. They're people who practice magic or rituals or whatever. And these people need to be, when we take power, they need to be given the death penalty. Straight up. I'm far more concerned about that than I am mass migration or non-white people. These people who are communing with demons, witchcraft and stuff, suppressing Christianity, they must be absolutely annihilated when we take power, end quote. Now, the reason I mention that, and there's another guy, James Lindsay, who's wandering around saying that the left is Gnostic and so on, and we can get into that. But the reason I mention it, in the book, I say that I would not be surprised if people on the right, in reaction to what's happening, resuscitate the inquisitional strain in Christianity that's been there. And because it's there, it's these things are like, just like you were saying, they're sort of embedded and they just kind of recur on their own, as it were. And so you get this inquisitional and it keeps coming back. I can totally imagine a confessional Christian political system in which dissidents see the people in power as archons and a demiurge in charge of a false reality. That's very possible. And how do we know this inquisitional is? Well, here you are, December 2023. The book is just published. Bingo, Nick Fuente says, you know, we really need an inquisition. We gotta kill people, right? We gotta kill some of these people. Well, okay. So, and Lindsay is going around saying, well, he uses Gnosticism as this term of political opprobrium, but it's completely disconnected from Gnosticism itself and from any aspect discussed in the book. Instead, it's applied as a term to the left. Again, it becomes this kind of inquisitionalism where mysticism, spirituality, different spiritual practices all become the enemy. And that's on the right. So this, you know, this is there. If I had waited to publish the book for a year, I could have incorporated all of this stuff that just corroborates what I was saying, what I alluded to in the book. I wanted to bring that in because it came up, it emerged after the book came out, but I predicted it. And sure enough, there it is. And I think it's a real danger. This kind of implicit inquisitionalism is not a solution. I'm sorry, Nick Fuentes, but you know, trying to kill witches is not going to resolve the problems we have. It's just not. So that's something I wanted to say. And it kind of comes out of what you were saying.
No, I'm very glad you did, because actually what you just said, without citing Nick Fuentes and James Lindsay, but just getting a sense of how things could go should the pendulum swing to the other side, is quite probable. And the other thing I was thinking as you were discussing all that, Arthur, is that if there is such a thing as a, you know, an archon and a demiurge that exists on a metaphysical level, that's exactly what they'd want us to do. They'd want, you know, the society to move and go witch hunting. And you know, for the purposes of discussion, you know, hypothetically and almost non-hypothetically, it seems that there's a good chance that there are things that exist on these other levels, which perhaps seek to influence large amounts of people in their own way. I think you've presented this danger very well. I'm glad you brought it up. I don't think it's something we've talked about here yet, or have we?
Well, we might have, maybe in our first conversation, because I think our first conversation might have been about your book, The New Inquisitions, right? And this is
right.
Like I've come back to that book numerous times over the past year or so, because I've been a fan of a lot of James Lindsay's work, but as soon as he started talking about, you know, Gnosticism, I just had to, shake my head. And as we chatted just a little bit before we started recording, but as you said then, it's like whenever he's called out on it, he just doubles and triples down. He will never change his opinion on this, even though he's completely wrong on it. And it's you've got a whole chapter in The New Inquisitions, which I think you published in 2005 or 2006. And you pretty much laid it all out there. You looked at Voegelin, and I mean, one of the points that stuck out for me, was if you look at the actual history of Gnostics and mystics and these inquisitions, I mean, the Gnostics have never been in power. Like the Gnostics have never been the ones that are in power. The Gnostics are always the ones that are persecuted. And so to even think that, we're looking at these like communist, Marxist movements and the new left in America, and to call them Gnostic is just kind of, it's ridiculous, because there's no, you have to go through a mental gymnastics course in order to start seeing like these 20th century, like totalitarian movements as Gnostic. The most charitably I can interpret them is that the totalitarian movements are, in a sense, they're like an anti-Gnosticism. Well, like that's how you put it. But what I mean by that is that they're like a caricature of Gnosticism. And there's even a sentence in the conclusion. I don't know if I'll be able to find it really quick, where, you, in reference to, where is it? Let's see. Thereby claiming that, I can't remember exactly what it is, but you basically say that, I think it was about materialism or something like that. And how it's almost like the from the materialist perspective, it's like materialism is their Gnosticism, or they claim to have Gnostic knowledge about materialism. But the point is that it's fake knowledge. So all Lindsay is really saying is that these people have this gnosis, this knowledge of something that's fake, but that's not what Gnosticism is. That's only what Gnosticism is if you're an inquisitional like Catholic who's looking at these Gnostics and saying, oh, well, they're obviously wrong, therefore, Gnosticism per se is wrong. But so to be charitable, you could make an argument that there's a slightly Gnostic structure to it, only in the sense that they claim to have this secret knowledge, about the way the world works, or respond to that.
Well, even that doesn't work very well, because literally nobody on the left ever that I have seen actually uses any of these metaphors, because they're the ones in power, actually. And as the ones in power, what are they doing? Well, Marxism is a dialectical, it's dialectical materialism. It's a materialistic, explicitly materialistic ideology. And by definition, when it takes over, for instance, in China, the Cultural Revolution, when it took over invaded Tibet, the destruction, who was destroyed, who was killed, well, it's the religious people in the French Revolution who, when the people in Western France rose up, who was it? Who did they kill? Well, it was those people, right? The religious people who resisted the French Revolution. So who are the victims? Who are the victims of the Inquisition? Exactly as you say. Giordano Bruno, the great mystic, great writer, philosopher, burned at the stake. Margarita Perret, burned at the stake. So you go back and you look at why do we know relatively little about Gnosticism? Because the texts were largely extirpated. And we only happened to find some in 1945 in a cave. Okay. So it's these, it's somehow it's a mental, it's this mental perversion where the victim becomes somehow imagined to be the source of the persecution. And to even get your head around that, to even be able to articulate it and get your head around it is ludicrous. I mean, it requires mental gymnastics of a form that are so bizarre that, you know, you just throw up your hands, you shake your head and say, well, you know, that's not worth even discussing, right? Because who are the inquisitors, right? It's the institutional system. And you look at contemporary, you know, the contemporary contemporary world, you look at the contemporary left, it's fundamentally anti-religious. It's not Gnostic. You don't find people referring to archons and demiurges and to gnosis on the left in a system of dialectical materialism. So that's just how it is. The problem comes in not with, you know, some poor misguided soul making these assertions that are unfounded. The problem comes in when it turns real, right? That's where things go south. And by that, I mean, when somebody takes seriously somebody like, you know, Nick Fuentes' remarks and starts inquisitional, you know, activity, or when the people in power say, well, we have to institute our ideology, and to do that, we have to extirpate the people who are against it. Well, who is that? It's people who are religious or spiritual or, you know, affirm non-materialistic premises. So, you know, it's very unfortunate. And I have little hope that you can stop it or turn it around for this or that individual going around with a Voegelinian kind of argument. But I have hope that even though it exists, it won't turn into something, right? It won't be actualized where people are hunting for mystics again and trying to, you know, kill off the Gnostics. That's, you know, that would be a very unfortunate consequence.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings to mind something that, that I've been thinking about recently based on Lobachevsky's work, because there's throughout that book, there's almost this, this recurring, well, it's an image, it's a theme, it's an observation. This maybe to sum it up as being like the real and the caricature. And he brings this up in several different ways. And one being, I'll just list a few of the examples, like one being the social structure, like Lobachevsky, he argues that basically the structure of society emerges as a result of it's implicit within the variety of human nature. So you have a big group of people or you have a group of people of any size. And of course, you'll have a ton of variation with people with different talents, different levels of intelligence, different strengths and weaknesses. And through the bonds and the roles that they all take, the kind of the meta result of that is a social structure. And in a Pythocracy, you get a caricature of a social structure, because that's that original social structure gets broken down. The social bonds between people get severed. People become distrustful of each other. The society breaks apart. The old class structure ceases to function, and a new class emerges from the individuals within all of the old groups. So it's this sifting and this shifting that happens, where you have this old structure, it gets broken down, and then from within all those groups, you have all of these individuals that then kind of come together to cluster to form the new class, the new nobility, as he calls it, the pathocratic leadership. So you have this caricature and then of the real thing. And then you've got, he talks about ideologies the same way. You can have an ideology and the pathocratic version of that ideology becomes a caricature of it. To the point where it barely, it's only using the same words, but even in its actual content and in what it actually wants and does, it's completely different. And so we have these various caricatures, and I hope I can remember where I was going with all of this. I think it was in relation to the Inquisitions. Okay, yes. So when it comes to the reaction to a social structure, he also points out that, well, I think the point of that is that there are two things that look the same, but they're different. They have different different natures. So on the surface, you might get the impression that they're the same thing, but underneath you see a very different inner reality. So you can see a social structure, but one happens to be this kind of pathological caricature version that has something completely different going on in it. The other is just what we consider a social structure. And when it comes to the reaction to authority, you can see the same thing. Because in a pathocracy, normal people react against that pathocracy. They see it as like against their nature. And that's kind of what we're talking about now. But there's another version of that, and that is the reaction of the potential pathocrats to a normal social structure. One of the points that Lobachevsky makes repeatedly is the way psychopaths see the world, you know, regardless of what's going on, they see normal human morality, they see love, they see religion as this strange system of oppression against them. They see laws as a system of oppression. So I can easily see like a kind of neo-Gnostic version that psychopaths in society would endorse, because they hate normality. They hate normal humanity. And I, in the new edition the recent edition of Ponerology that we put out a year or so ago or two ago, I've got some quotes from the kind of Antifa activist left. This was in the CHAZ, what did CHAZ even stand for? Autonomous Zone of Central Capitol Hill.
Zone. Yeah.
Right. And so there was like pamphlets and literature that were being handed out there. And there were two quotes that I found. I think it was in Andy Ngo's book on Antifa. So there were some quotes from the literature that was handed out. And it was something like, I can't remember the exact phrase, but I'll paraphrase, something like our disdain for the police is only exceeded by our hatred for this entire goddamn world, or something like that. Right. And so there's this completely like anti-human and like almost like the caricature of Gnosticism being anti-worldly, right? Because you make the distinction between being like, how did you put it? Not anti-current social situation or the structure of society as it currently is and anti-world itself. So there is a tendency among a certain demographic that are absolutely, that see the world itself, see humanity as sick and oppressive, even when to the vast majority of people it would be like, no, that's actually when things are good. It's because of a deep like sickness in the mind of, for instance, like a psychopath. So all of that, you know, all of what I'm just saying is kind of was inspired by the Nick Fuentes quote, because I think that when we're looking at political dissidents, in a period of time when things are up in the air, it's not like there's ever a situation where it's good guys and bad guys, right? there are potential pathocrats in every social movement, and so there are people like in the dissident right which. It's not that they hate the left. It's that they hate like laws and normality, and they would hate any like anyone in charge. And they would like nothing more than to, once they get into power, to kill a whole bunch of people.
Well, the risk, is definitely historically greater on the left, actually, in terms of the amount, the number of deaths. That's the truth, and it's the historical truth. And reaction against that and wanting to return to normal, to a normal human society is not surprising, really. There's no doubt that Lobachevsky has insights. He was very insightful, and that came from direct observation and direct experience. So, and yes, you can have pathocrats emerge, gain power, but that requires a pathocracy, which is a particular kind of materialistic, pseudo-religious ideology. It's a particular type of ideology. So, what I'm saying is that a rise of a confessional Christian Inquisition is not an answer to a pathocracy. Mm-hmm. Potentially, it could create a pretty toxic social mix based on, comments like I read earlier. So it's not, what I'm saying is that it's not a healthy response to pathocracy as such, but it isn't necessarily the case that opposition to an emerging pathocracy is therefore itself pathocratic. I don't think that's the case. That's the case. I think that like Czesław Miłosz wrote about, he also had experience behind the Iron Curtain growing up. And in The Captive Mind, he writes about this experience. And under a secular materialist communist authority, people live in fear and they have to develop a false mindset. They are compelled to falsify, to create a mask, to put forward a false self in order to survive in that environment. And that's, he discusses that at length in Captive Mind from an experiential point of view, what it's actually like to do that. That's relatively new in the world, actually. This is a modern phenomenon, what he's describing in Captive Mind. What's the opposite to that? What is the antidote to that? It's not more centralization. It is a decentralized, healthy, balanced society, culture. It's the development of culture that has a spiritual center and that encourages empathy. What characterizes pathocrats is a lack of empathy. It's a lack of compassion. It's a lack of ability to understand the other. What characterizes mysticism is the opposite of that. It is compassion. It is empathy. It is understanding. It's kindness. That's implicit in mysticism. And it's inherent in spirituality itself. So that, I think, is a different way of describing the antidote to pathocracy. But the problem is, once these, and this is something that he experienced, once a pathocracy is empowered and in control, how do you get there? How do you get to that, right? That's a good question, right?
Well, that's so what Lobachevsky, one of the points that he makes, and I think it was kind of, I wouldn't say exemplified, but illustrated in Rod Dreher's book, Live Not by Lies. Did you read that one, Arthur?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to kind of put those two, like Dreyer and Lobachevsky together, like one of the things that Lobachevsky points out is, I think from his perspective, okay, well, so from his perspective, looking at things historically and trying to determine the laws of pathocracy, like the naturalistic, you know, processes and phases and how it all goes together, he'd basically say that just left on its own, if just looked at like historically in terms of a phenomenon that wasn't understood at the time, the way it plays out and the way it will play out in the future, if no one kind of knows what's going on, is that there's kind of a point of no return once a pathocracy starts developing. And at that point, once it's kind of entrenched, it will be decades before those social bonds that I talked about reestablish themselves and what he calls the society of normal people develops. And the primary example for him, which he lived under, would be Poland. So he's talking about communism is imposed, you know, around the like late 40s, 1950, around there. And then it took decades before the society of normal people was able to essentially reestablish itself and become a force that would pose a threat to the pathocracy. And so what did we see like in the historical record? Well, that was like in the 70s and the 80s, we saw the rise of the Solidarity movement. And then by the mid 80s, Lobachevsky was pretty much predicting the nonviolent fall of communism because of the rise of this society of normal people. And that we wouldn't see a major bloody counter-revolution. It would be a largely bloodless, just changing of the guard as the system just fell apart and normal people reasserted themselves. But he would pretty much say, again, all things being equal, it'll take decades of a pathocracy to reach that point. And to put that together with Dreyer talks about the religious almost, like there's a thread of mysticism I see like running through those Christian groups, like underground groups, that was one of the ways that they reestablished those ties with each other is through their spirituality, through their religion. And old like denominations and like sectarian differences ceased to matter under a pathocracy because they all got to the heart of the matter. They all realized like they could put all that stuff aside as being like irrelevant to the matter at hand, which was not only survival, but the survival of their spirits and their souls. And they people would come together of different denominations, and they'd get together in these groups and have these, it would be like an underground church. And the spirituality arguably in religion, and Lobachevsky talks about this too, was one of the most important things for creating that social cohesion, that bond, well, and that religion, that religare, that, you know, binding togetherness. And that's just from like a sociological perspective, not even taking into account the kind of metaphysical stuff that might be going on there and the significance of that. So I think in that sense that we could tie all of this together, and even these neo-Gnostic elements, is that there's something like pathocracy is a sign of a deep social and spiritual illness and disease. And there's this anti-religious and anti-spiritual component to it, that it seeks to destroy that in other people. And yet, the resistance to that is formed by the people affirming and rediscovering those things, and they acquire the kind of power and vitality that they lacked, maybe, you know, before the imposition of pathocracy, because people got complacent and were, you know, and hedonistic, and the feeling of the Archon's boot on one's throat is kind of like a motivation to rediscover these values and these experiences, and it creates the crucible, you know, that alchemical crucible from which emerge these new but old values, these perennial values. And so
that's right, and they do recur, and you see that actually in contemporary China. You do have the reemergence of the ancient traditions to some extent, Taoism and Confucianism, Taoism in particular, Buddhism to some limited extent. You know, with the exception of occupied Tibet, but otherwise, you know, there are these those elements recurring. Why? Because they're intrinsic to the nature of people. They're there literally for millennia, and so they've developed and they reflect these underlying aspects that ultimately can't really be extinguished. That are part of human aspiration. So, you know, that aspect is part of what I'm, you know, what I'm discussing in American Gnosis. And you see that also in Russia. And actually, at the end of the book, I draw on John Michael Greer and his reflections on the emergence ultimately in the future. I talk about theories of history and the idea that, which has recurred in a number of places, that the even prophetic kinds of, you know, even prophetic kinds of ideas about Russia and America as having this, you know, ultimately spiritual significance and a spiritual destiny, that's definitely deep in Russian thinking and, you know, in Russian thought and literature. So what do you see in Russia? Well, you do see the reemergence of some very ancient traditions now, including Russian paganism. There are things, a friend of mine wrote a book on occult Russia, which is extremely interesting. It's not a cult the way you might think of it. It's a cult in the sense of hidden but recurring, these ancient spiritual traditions that include orthodoxy and paganism reemerging. Why are they reemerging after all of these, you know, all of the things that Russian people suffered? Well, because they're intrinsic. They're embedded in that culture. And so, of course, they're going to reemerge. And the same is true also of the American current. There are, in a lot of my work has to do with the American spiritual current, you could say. And that includes people like Ralph Waldo Emerson and the other transcendentalists. It includes people like Franklin Merrill Wolfe. It includes, you know, somebody contemporary like Joel Morwood. It includes a whole array of figures who represent something independent. It's an independent kind of spirituality. You can call it perennialist, perhaps, but it has its own intrinsic character. And there's something kind of mysterious about that. And it just keeps recurring. It's not like it is necessarily conscious, even. It's in the sense that, oh, I'm an Emersonian. It's rather you see this pattern of perspective recurring. So there's something to that, which is cultural, that is not explicable in really materialistic paradigm. And I think that's a really vital element for understanding American history and American literature and culture. And I think it's a vital element also for understanding Russian. So regardless of these kind of prophetic ideas, you know, that Edgar Cayce or others have put forward, I think there's a different way of understanding it, which, you know, Ken Wilber also represents to some extent. I mean, he also represents this American tradition. And that, to say that is not to say I'm an integralist, you know, or that I'm a Wilberian or whatever you want to say. It's just objectively, you see these patterns recurring. That's how it is. And that has a significance which is more than material. So, and it's a cause for optimism, because these traditions or these cultural elements resurge. They resurge. And that's cause for hope, I think. And that's part of what this book is about, too. These patterns are recurring, and you see them recurring in American thought. And I think that's really vital. I think it's really important. Even if this or that figure, you know, you're not going to buy into this or that, maybe not reptilians or from another other dimensions or you don't want to go there. That's fine. But still, these patterns recur, and they have intrinsic importance, vitality. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an important thing to say.
And there's such a rich history, in the sense that there's a lot to choose from in the clothes that any new culture arising like you quote from Greer takes. Because even there's even a Christian theosophic, you know, American, you know, tradition that can be drawn from I can't remember their names, but the groups, I think they were in Pennsylvania, right? That came over.
Yeah, there were others as well, but definitely there was Ephrata in Pennsylvania, you know, Wissahickon community. There was one in Michigan, actually. And there were some others that were more scattered elsewhere. And I've actually talked with descendants of people from that tradition who brought theosophy to the United States. This is something that I've been thinking a lot about. And actually, I have a book coming out. I've already submitted it. It's with Inner Traditions. And it's a book about the alchemy of culture. And it's called Gathering Light. And it's drawing on the classical alchemical tradition, going back to the Emerald Tablet and, you know, Greek antiquity and before that Egypt, but it's also drawing on the theosophical practices of alchemy, spiritual alchemy. And so I discuss that. And then in the book, I also discuss how culture emerges and what living culture is and how you develop decentralized alchemical culture, how alchemy is a way of understanding how healthy culture emerges. So you go through the dark period, you go through the period of the sifting, you go through the period of illumination, you go through the period of the reddening and the final phase and the culmination. And that is a way of understanding how healthy culture. It's the exact, in some ways, it's the app. What I'm looking at is the opposite of political ponderology, where he's looking at how the sick, you know, how the sick society comes into being and how long it takes to get rid of the thing. And what I'm looking at is, okay, how does healthy culture, decentralized culture emerge? What are its characteristics? What makes for a full cultural understanding that includes spiritual aspects, including recognition that there are unseen aspects to our world, right? Because that's part of these traditions. There's, of course, Chinese alchemy. There's Indian alchemy. I'm primarily drawing on European alchemical tradition, because I'm European in background, and so I'm drawing on European tradition. But I also draw a little bit on Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and you know, I don't really refer but to Chinese or Indian alchemy, but the principles are actually very similar. And you have these stages of alchemy, You have this transformation. And so what I'm trying to do with that book is explore. It's a book of co-exploration with people of these themes. And I don't know when they're going to publish it because I don't know their time frame. They have their own, you know, mysteries of publishing. So, and their own schedule. So we'll see when it comes out, but it's been submitted and it has some rare chemical texts in it, actually. First time they've ever been published in a book, turns out.
Wow, looking forward to that one.
It sounds really interesting. I wanted to ask you about American Gnosis because it's been out for a few months already. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if there have been any reactions or responses from quarters that you wouldn't have expected to hear from.
Well, with that book, I've done quite a number of podcasts. I did a live stream, which brought in a lot of people. Comparatively, I mean, it's an academic book. I wanted it in the academic system. I wanted it to be embedded in the Oxford ecosystem. And sure enough, it is. And that gives me to this day, I even think about it. And I'm very happy that it's in there. And so that's good. I have gotten a lot of back and forth with people. I've had people contact me from all kinds of unexpected places. So, and sometimes it's people who have come to they've come to the same kinds of things, but the book articulates it in a much more explicit way, in a coherent way, where there's a whole way of understanding. It's not just like I go through these things. The book gives a whole new way of seeing things, really, if you go through the whole book. And so people have responded to that very positively. What's a little surprising for an academic book is that it's reaching people that are not academic. Partly that's because they put the book on sale, right? They had a Christmas sale, and it wasn't just my book, a bunch of them. It just happened that coincided with podcasts that I was. And so I put the information out there. And so it kind of helped sales, get it 50% off. And so, I then got responses from people that you would not normally get from an academic book, right? Because it's supposed to be academic and boring, and it goes to people who really are just, kind of going through the motions a lot of times. And that's not the case. So I've gotten all kinds of interesting responses on it. I'm overall happy with the book, and I'm happy with the response to it. It was meant to reach the people that it has been reaching. Of course, there are going to be people who don't like it, and that's just how it is. Why will they not like it? Well, we can really predict that. It's pretty predictable. So that's how it is. That's the world we live in.
That's the world we live in, and I hope many people get to read it precisely because of the fact that you make a lot of things explicit in the book. You create this framework for understanding a lot of what you discuss that makes a lot of the subject matter accessible to people who may not be so familiar with many of the people and the ideas that you present. And I also wanted to ask you, any sense as to when it is going to come out in soft cover?
Or if.
It should. You never know with, academic publishers. Platonic Mysticism did come out in a accessible hardcover or a soft paper version, after a year, and it sold quite well. And because of the publicity that I've been doing, for this book, I would anticipate it will happen. I don't know for sure because you never know. With any of these, once you sign it off into these systems, then
it's out of your hands.
There were surprises in the production of the book as well that I won't go into, because it's really a system. I mean, it's a machine almost. That's not the case with every publisher. Some of them, it's very humane. It's very human centric. We'll see, but I hope it does. I think it will reach more people. But even as it is, it's been surprising. And, you know, I was contacted instantly by a scholar from Poland who we've become friends as a result of this and going back and forth. And there are many things, including Lobachevsky, that are very interesting for him.
cool.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, Arthur, do you have time for maybe one more question or thread, or how are you doing for time?
We're okay. We can do one more.
Okay.
Then we'll need to draw it to a close.
All right. I wanted to get back to this, kind of like a bonus question for everyone that's stuck through to the end. I wanted to get back to the question that came up just a little bit on when we were talking about Neo-Gnosticism as kind of a natural response to a certain socio-political situation, but also as kind of perhaps hinting at other realities. But to get into this, in regards to culture, one of the big things about American culture is for the past 70 plus years has been kind of a weird kind of culture, in the sense that it's it's reviled and yet always there and ever and always present, sometimes just under the surface. And that's like UFO culture, the UFO phenomenon. Now, of course, in recent years, it's been getting a lot more publicity, especially in the last year with the congressional hearings and proposed legislation talking about non-human intelligences and UAP craft and all kinds of weird stuff. And even the title of your book reminded me of Diana Pasulka, because you've got American Gnosis and she's got American Cosmic, totally different books, but with some overlap. And
yeah.
I guess I just want to know your thoughts on that, on just that whole situation. Of course, it's a big topic, so just a few thoughts. But and of course, UFOs are part of the book. You've got David Icke here, of course. You've got Serrano talking about with his esoteric Hitlerism and all the Nazi UFOs that we were joking about in our first talk on the book. I just want to hear a few of your thoughts on that whole scene and where it might fit into your work, how you see it, how you might see the future, just anywhere you want to go with that.
Sure. I will say very briefly that one of the reasons that I think UFO or aliens or that whole kind of area has so much magnetic, it has a kind of magnetic quality to it. So it draws people to it, and it's hard to drop it. Why is that? Well, it's both a little bit materialistic, but at the same time, it's not really subject to materialism the way we have it inculcated into us, right? There's something about it that breaks the paradigm, maybe not completely, right? But it partially breaks the paradigm. And so because of that, it becomes a kind of area where it's like a window where non-physical dimensions or other dimensions or beings that don't belong to the materialist paradigm, they become somehow socially acceptable. They become partially acceptable. And so it's part of, I think, also the breakdown to some extent of a materialistic paradigm that this phenomena represents. I think that's partly what it represents. There are also other aspects, and Mises, he explored this quite a bit, you know, other dimensions, other aspects of nature, other aspects of the cosmos that we can't see, but that nonetheless exist, in elements, beings in the cosmos that exist, but we can't necessarily see with our eyes, but nonetheless they exist. All of this is there in American Gnosis, and it's also there in American Cosmic. And, you know, she and I sat down and we talked when she was here a few years ago when that book came out. I brought her in as a speaker, and we had some very interesting conversations. Part of what she discusses in her book is how some of the, and in her other work, is how some of her sources in her primary source work. How do they work in terms of their contacting these non-human intelligences? Very interesting description. It actually fits into American Gnosis. It fits in there. It in the paradigm that I kind of outline. The main source that she has, and others that she knows work through a kind of attunement, there's a process of becoming aware, of becoming familiar, of connection. Well, you can call this spirituality if you want. You cannot use that term, but it occupies a space that's not explicitly religious, and it's also not explicit. It's clearly not secular exactly. So what is it? It seems to me like what she's writing about is a pretty American phenomenon, really. You know, it's this independent spirituality of a type. That's not to say that everything in UFO literature or every alien being is necessarily benign. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that there are elements that fit in this paradigm that I outline in this book. There's overlap, as you say. And she's someone I'd suggest people read if you haven't read her work. She's quite interesting, Diana Pasulka. And, you know, there's overlap. And I think there is an American current which has characteristics, just as there's a Russian current that has Russian characteristics. And these recur. And that's what you see in these phenomena also. And they're beyond any individual. They're beyond us. They're beyond me. They're beyond her. They're beyond us as individuals. And that's part of what these books are about. And that's what I explore. And it's really been fun to talk with you. You know, I enjoy our conversations. You're fearlessly exploring things which, why not? Why not? Why shouldn't we explore these things? These are things that are worth exploring. And that's what I'm all about. So I'm glad to share it with you guys. It's really been fun.
Same here.
Same here. All right. Well, thanks, Arthur.